Hello and welcome back to the Unseen Incidents podcast. It's me, your host Patrick Van Scharten, and on this week's episode, we're looking forward to the start of the Premier League season, running over the teams who can be expected to compete for the Champions League spots. Who is going to win the title? We decide today. Then we open up the burn book. While over on the paid side, we're answering some of your questions on what Man United could do with Marcus Rashford, who we've got our eyes on in the Championship, and who we would take from our club's history to play for our current team, plus a bunch of other stuff in ABF. That's all on today's episodes of Unseen Incidents. So we're back for another doubleheader. Pete Dorman, good to see you, man. Good to see you for a second time in just a few days. I saw you very recently. I saw you at the weekend.
We met up IRL. For your 37th birthday. It was a very lovely evening. It was good to see you in your little sailor outfit. I'm sure people who follow you on Instagram have questions as to why or what was the reason behind the...
Because we were on a boat. Because we were on a boat.
Oh, of course. Yeah, the was it a barge or is it an actual boat?
Is a barge not a species of boat?
All barges are boats, but all boats are barges.
It's a real
fingers and thumb type thing.
Yeah. So I think, yes, it is like a barge, I guess, but it's converted into a restaurant. I guess technically we weren't even on the barge, right? We were on the like pontoon thing attached to it. But
so much so that I forgot that we were actually on a barge.
How did you do that?
Well, it just felt like we were sitting right beside the river.
Yeah, we were right beside the river. And but when you get up to go to the loo and suddenly you realize that the kind of surface you're walking on is like cambered, then you become aware of it. But yeah, Emma suggested the venue, and then once we agreed on it, I said, well, obviously we've got to have a dress code. And she said, obviously we should do nautical, and that was it. I was like, all right, okay, yeah, no further questions. You want to do a fun, I don't know, like a fun theme. You do want to do it, but you also don't want your friends who are coming to your party, potentially paying for a babysitter, potentially paying for cabs, paying for food, all that kind of stuff. You don't want them to also have to like go and buy specific garments just so that they can stay in keeping with your silly theme, right? Mm. You want it to be fun for everybody else the way it's fun for you. And like the great thing about something like nautical is that nobody has to buy anything. Like everybody's got something they can wear. If you want to buy something, you can. But like everybody has a striped blue and white t-shirt or even just a blue shirt and white trousers or something. Like everybody's got something that will pass. Now, if you don't want to just pass, if, for example, you want to buy a vintage navy surplus sailor hat for example, then you do have to go and buy that, but I didn't want it to be onerous.
I did also make a purchase.
Well, sure, but like it being an excuse to make a purchase is nice. It being kind of compulsory to make a purchase, less nice.
Yeah, I mean,
which thing did you buy?
The long sleeve t-shirt, the striped long sleeve t-shirt.
Mm-hmm. That's, look, I would say I've done you a favor there.
Also,
I would say that's a basic.
I got it from TM Luton, and they do 5 for £50 on t-shirts, and two of them were discounted at £8, so it was £46, and I can return as many of the other ones as I wish.
Pretty good.
So it's essentially I can't remember how much that one was. It was either £8 or £10, which is astonishingly cheap for... I've not washed it yet. It's in the wash at the minute. So we'll see how it comes out. But the quality seems actually quite impressive for the price.
Yeah. I'm always kind of shocked at how genuinely expensive like proper Breton tops are.
Mm.
Like it is actually quite alarming. You know, if you want to get one of the real French ones, they'll run you like £60 to £100.
Yeah.
It's insane. And you're like, this is just like a cotton t-shirt.
It's the same as all those like all the bare white t-shirts that everybody went nuts for. They're like £60-£70.
But those have always been expensive. Like, I mean, I'm not saying it is the same thing, I guess. But like they have a reason to be expensive in a way. In that they are usually tubular knits, right?
They're
knitted on a machine which can do them. Most machines can't do them. Like, and also, I think that's
production
kind of
takes
like
longer, yeah.
And it's like
and doesn't scale as well.
What do you fucking call it? It's like Merz Bischwanen's like big thing. Right?
Yeah, that's a famous one.
They've been doing that shit whether people ask them to or not, forever.
But I feel like nobody bought them 10 years ago. Certainly not on the same level.
I'd heard of the brand before the Bear.
Mm.
Because I feel like, do you not remember there was a period of what felt like 10 years where every single video you saw on Instagram was how to buy here's the perfect white t-shirt. Like, these are the perfect white t-shirts. We all know that we're engaged on a kind of, crusade-like quest to find the perfect white tee.
Yeah,
I don't give a shit about white t-shirts.
It's the male version of the little black dress.
Yes.
Perfect white tee.
Where they're like, everyone looks good in it. It's like, no one looks good in it. Mm. No one looks good in it. It's boring. Like, white t-shirts are good to have, but I think one of the best bits of somebody asked me the other day, like, because I'm in a little group chat with a couple of like guys who are into buying clothes, and
you're in a fashion group chat.
Yeah, I am a bit with Tom, who you'll have met.
Yeah.
On the barge.
On the barge.
Aboard the SS Patrick Van Straten.
SS Patrick Van Straten.
Yeah, don't clip that.
Yeah. Dress in Hugo Boss.
It would be good now if I knew what the, you know, the letters are at the beginning of like a German boat. Yeah. But if we were boats, I would be a barge and you would be a U-boat, I think.
I'd be SS something. Yeah.
Yeah, we're in this little group chat and one of the guys in it was just like, what's the best bit of fashion, like, style advice you've ever got? And I do remember at one point somebody just saying, like, why would I waste money on things like t-shirts? They're just generic things. You can just get a good one affordably and, like, don't go searching for the perfect one. Mm. Spend your money on other things. And I do think, like, underwear, t-shirts, like, I'm not going to spend money on that shit.
Yeah, so I go... Underwear, I'm basically exclusively the boxed under Calvin Klein's, but I wait until they're on like a ridiculous offer. Like once a year somewhere, they always go like 60% off and just buy like three packets. And also, you don't need to replace them that often. You replace them like every 18 months, 18 months, 2 years. Once they start showing visible signs of wear, I don't remember. I'm fine with underwear. T-shirts, I used to buy quite expensive name brand t-shirts, but like minimalist versions of them. Mm-hmm. So they would just have a little logo. I still have some Comme des Garçons one, but that kind of vibe where it's just a little logo on the breast, small, and then the t-shirt is quote unquote high quality and you'd spend like 60-80 quid on them. And after a while I was like, this is literally just a black t-shirt. I can go to like a Uniqlo and get five of these. And I guess it kind of amplified once we had Bonnie, because I don't want to be spending 80 quid on a white t-shirt and then have her throw half of her lunch at it, or I pick her up and she's like got berries all over her hands and she just like rubs them into my shirt. That happens literally all the time.
Or when you like wipe their mouths after they've had something with like chocolate or berries in it or something, and then somehow 10 minutes later they're still emitting more, like more comes out, and they smile at you and like chocolatey dribble runs down their chin and you're like, I thought we were safe.
Yeah. Bonnie just keeps milk in her mouth for a bit sometimes. And she smiles and you see it like pulling at the bottom of her, like underneath her tongue for no reason. But it's like, stuff like that. I'm like, I still want to buy nice clothes. So knitwear and all that stuff. I'll be much more careful about the scenarios I wear and that when I take it off. If it's like, okay, I need to pick up Bonnie a lot here, I'm probably going to take off my jumper and put it away. But with white t-shirts or just generic t-shirts, I was like, they kind of need to be more cannon foddery than... Yeah. A really expensive thing that you're prizing and trying to like avoid any stain at all and keep it in pristine condition. It just doesn't work.
That's where I think shirts come in. I've really come around to shirts again. I think firstly a collar makes stuff more interesting.
Yeah.
But also you can obviously like get linen shirts very easily, whereas linen t-shirts, like I have a couple, but they're not easily come by. And with shirts as well, you can get pattern shirts. So that, like, when your child throws shit at you, nobody really knows. It's completely fine. I feel like they're a bit more versatile. Also, sometimes if you end up wearing shorts and a t-shirt, you're like, I don't know. I feel like this is aggressively not a fit.
Yeah, I said this.
Whereas
the last podcast we do.
Long sleeves, and somebody described this recently where they were like, trousers and short sleeves, fine. Long sleeves and shorts, fine. Short sleeves and shorts, no good.
Yeah, it makes you look like a toddler. It's like how we dress children for nursery.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just doesn't work.
It's practical fit. And sometimes, you know, there's a time for practical fit. Like, I turned up to have lunch with a friend today and I was like, just don't start with me, you know. Just don't start with me. It's hot as fuck. You know, sometimes you just got to do.
You just got to get through the day.
Yeah, exactly. You got to wear a practical fit. So today I was like, I have a short sleeved linen shirt. That is what is going on. Even though it's like, as you can see, it's like
It's kind
colorless.
Of like granddad collar.
Yeah, but it makes me feel like my dad because it looks kind of like off duty priest. Like that's how I feel in it.
The collar's out.
Yeah, I'm just like
all better off.
Yeah. Let me tell you about somebody else who got together his friends for a very special meal. Anyway, let's do the podcast because like we're both burning up. We've both checked. What have you got? You got 26 point something, and I've got 30
I can tell you the temperature in every important room in my house.
Yeah, I've been trying to like get the monitor in a position where I can see it.
See that?
Oof. I don't like that. That's like get COVID tests.
Some dad shit, yeah. It's just all little Bluetooth thermometers. Nursery, loft, living room, bedroom. Some aggressive dad shit.
Nice. So everywhere's much of a muchness though.
Yeah,
everywhere's like 27.
High 20s. High, between 25 and 30, yeah.
Well, I'm actually out-dadding you because Goldie's room is a balmy 24.
Ooh, that's good. But are you using VTech? What's your...
VTech?
Your...
My monitor.
Monitor of choice.
Baby Sense.
Okay, so I don't have any data on that, but I do have data on VTech. And based on the actual thermometers that we bought, or like the actual specific thermometers, VTech runs about a degree and a half too hot. So it says it's 29, okay. But it's actually 27 and a half.
Okay. I would also say that like even that is better than the worst. Like I remember the first summer, the summer that Coco was one, that was the year it got up to 40.
Yeah.
And I remember it getting up to like 31 in Coco's room.
Mm.
And I was like, that's fucking scary when you've got a one-year-old. And so that was when I said, you know, Sky used to have all those things. What? It's so boring, people. But Sky, but there are so many... Sky did have really good benefits. I was also thinking about that because I went to the dentist this morning. And fuck me, do I miss Sky after that, who's just pay for all our NHS dentistry.
Mm.
But they just had like a bunch of, obviously, you know, deals that you could get as a Sky employee, right? And one of their deals back then was 40% off at AEG.
Oh, shit, that's good.
So I was like, right, I need to buy an air conditioner.
Yeah.
I went to AEG and got, you know, a 500 quid air conditioner for 300 quid.
Mm.
And it's like my pride and joy. And but I remember when that happened in our antenatal group, we were all texting each other, like the temperatures that it was in our kids' room. And the highest was 33. And I was like, man, putting your kid together at 33 is like putting them in bed. I think I'd put them in the bathroom at that point or something. Like that is fucking terrifying. Because heat is such a...
Yeah, and they can't regulate their body temperature.
Yeah, exactly.
We got up there probably first when she was about 4 months old in France. And it was probably low 30s in that room at one point.
Oof.
Yeah, but she was fine. And also, she didn't really wake up. Like, she doesn't seem that phased by heat.
There's also different kinds of heat, you know? Like yeah, I think they do manage it better than us. Because, like, nursery is also fucking boiling hot. But we just sneak in and open their windows after dark and you get a breeze. Like, even this summer, there have been days where it's like 31, but really breezy. And it feels better than the days when it's 27, but still. So
We were walking up the road and it was like 26 degrees on last weekend.
Yeah.
And Jess and I were both like absolutely melting because there was no breeze. It just felt so much warmer than it was. But yeah.
All right. Let's get off weather and let's get into...
this summer.
I know, right? Year. But I'm hoping we get through next week and then we're going down to my in-laws on the coast. So it'll be much cooler there. But Emma and Coco are in Finland right now with Dahlia, who is also at my party. And they're sending me pictures. They're wearing fucking coats and jumpers.
Yeah, it's like 15 degrees colder.
And I was like, I think we might need to move to Finland.
I'm
serious, man. Like I said this to Emma the other day. I was like, what I'm about to say, you're going to think I'm fucking with you, but I'm completely serious. We may need to think about where we end up living in the long run because I just don't think I can handle...
South of England.
I just don't think... I don't think I can handle London being like 35 degrees...
Every year.
For all in, you know, several weeks of the summer.
Yeah, like, I think we'll probably end up with between 3 and 5 weeks worth of 30s.
Of 30 plus, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is insane. You're right. So, I mean, obviously, what we'll do before then is I was like, right, when we've got some money, you know, Emma's going back to work. Like, when we've got the money, we will just put proper aircon in our house. Like, that is obviously the next thing we'll do.
And maybe plumb it in.
Yeah, plumb it in. And I do think that, you know, in 10 years' time, when people are buying houses in the south of England, they'll be like, does it have aircon?
Or do you need to factor that in?
Yeah, but I mean, you're not going to regret doing it. Like, we probably won't move now until the girls leave school.
Primary school or secondary school?
Oh, fuck. That's our
plan. Then fucking stick it in.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like, we got our boiler changed last year when we'd kind of ummed and ahed about it. And then we were like, we're probably going to stay here till they go to uni now. So fuck it, let's just do it. But yeah, I think that, like, maybe if we did that, we'd say, you know what? If we all just sleep in the cool, then who gives a fuck? But otherwise, I was like, maybe this is where we do move to fucking Edinburgh. You know, maybe this is, there aren't that many places. I was like, we're basically Edinburgh or Scandinavia, really. And Copenhagen is the most appealing of all the Scandinavian cities, but it'll be warmer than a lot of the others. And also Danish is literally fucking impossible. You know, like, it is fucking impossible. I think it's the most impossible of all of them. That's at least my feeling.
Of the European languages, I would say.
Of the Scandi languages. Yeah, I can't make head or tail of it. It's fucking impossible. Like, people say things to you in Danish, and I was like, if I'm looking at the text in front of me, you know, like in a restaurant.
You can figure it out. You can reverse engineer it to understand enough
with
to get
Danish,
by. Yeah.
Danish, it's really hard to do that. Anyway, whatever. That's kind of where I am at the moment. So we'll see. But something else is heating up, Pete. And it's the 26-27 Premier League season. We thought that today we'd talk a little bit about the teams at the top of the table, or expected to be at the top of the table, who we think the favourites are, what they've done this summer, blah, blah, blah. I don't know how you want to do this. Like, it would take quite a long time to go through team by team, but maybe we should do that to some degree. Do you have, maybe a good way to ask it is this. Of the five teams we've got, because we're going to look at Arsenal, City, Chelsea, Liverpool, United. Sorry, Spurs. Like, if Spurs are in this, then great. Like, you can laugh at us later, but like,
there's a lot going on there.
There's too much. We can't cover every team. Do you have tiers within these five? If you had to separate it out, are you like, well, I'll discount that team and that team from like the title race?
Yes. So I have tiers for genuine title contenders. I then have kind of like a half tier and then a main tier below that. If you know what I mean, there's like a semi tier in between.
Okay.
Yeah, so I have two at the top, then like a third one that I think is maybe potentially going to sit on its own for one specific reason, and then two at the bottom, four and five.
Okay, I'd say I have three and a half tiers.
Three and a half tiers, okay.
So I have three solid tiers, and then I have one team which is only just outside one of those tiers. So okay, might as well put our cards on the table.
Speaking of fucking riddles here.
Bottom tier, Manchester United. Maybe let's just go through it like that. Is Man United in your bottom tier?
Man United is... I have Man United fifth of five.
So this is the thing. Like, the Man United conversation is getting a bit out of hand at the moment. People like Paul Scholes popping up and saying, oh, it'd be Chelsea United for the title. And I was like, United were pretty good last season. But they were pretty good in a season where the league was very deep, but the top teams were not outstanding. I think that's fair to say. That I think the league as a whole, better than it's ever been. The top teams, not special, really. Those two things are obviously related. But at the same time, like, nobody could think that Chelsea were operating at max capacity last season.
Yeah.
Spurs were 17th. Like, there's a lot going into it. Liverpool sacked their manager. In fact, everybody sacked their manager. But yeah, this talk that's going around about United. United were pretty good last season. They've kept the manager who came in the middle of the season and made their numbers slightly worse. That's how I was talking to Ted about it, and he was like, well, the numbers got slightly worse, and my angle on it was, if the numbers get slightly worse but the vibes are good and you're getting minutes for like Mainu and Heaven
and the system's better,
Euro, like, for these kids,
yeah,
like, if you're operating at the same level while playing all these kids, I think that's pretty good.
Yeah, I agree.
But Carrick, I look around the managers of the top teams and I'm like, question mark about Maresca, but Carrick looks the weakest of these managers to me. And the United squad is just like fine. I think I like the moves they've done so far this summer. So I would say that in midfield, they've taken a bit of a gamble on Santos.
Yeah.
But I think given the season he had a couple of years ago in Strasbourg, given what he's shown at Chelsea, which is not perfect, but there's promise, like, and given his age, 50 mil is a little bit higher than you'd want to go, but completely fine. Mm-hmm. I like that move. This is the kind of move that I've wanted United to do for ages. Tielemans, I think, is pretty good as well. I think the money is fine. He is old. He is slow. He is not going to give you anything defensively.
Yeah.
He also does give you lots of progressive passing out of midfield. I think there are games, maybe not league games, but certainly cup games, where you can probably get away with playing him as a 10 and rest Bruno entirely. I think you can do that.
Mm.
In some dead rubbish.
But you should have missed mine for that.
If Mason Mount's fit, then great. That helps a lot.
He went off after 20 minutes of preseason.
But my point is that Tielemans gives you creative passing as well as progressive passing. I think that's fine. Like, it's not that expensive. I think he's a good player. He's a good player. Like these are definitely good things for them to do. Elsewhere, have they done anything?
No, I think the whole ethos seems to be to build from within. United have historically been... they've gone out and bought expensive players that haven't worked out. A lot of expensive mistakes. And I think Carrick's idea is to try and build and develop the players that they have. Because there are some interesting young players there. But I think that United's squad is fine. It is not significantly better than it is last season. I think they were lucky to finish where they finished last season. It was more a result of their surroundings as opposed to them being truly like the third best team in the league. Mm-hmm. And yeah, okay, like Santos and Tielemans, I'm more on the fence about them, to be honest. I think Santos is fine, but also buying Chelsea's fourth choice centre mid for a team who you're expecting to finish above in the season, in the league, it doesn't fill me with a huge amount of hope. But again, the age is fine. Tielemans, I'm a little bit more down on him than you. I think he is too old. I'm significantly concerned about his drop-off as well, from 29 to, say, 31, 32. If you look at the amount of minutes he's played, I would say he's actually closer to like a 31, 32-year-old than he is a 29-year-old. He's played over 33,000 league minutes across his career. Yeah. He started his senior league career at 16. First season, he played over 2,000 minutes. Compare that to, say, Bruno Guimarães. He's 6 months younger, I think. They're born the same year. They're both born in 1997. Bruno G has 21,000 career league minutes. So 12,000 less than Tielemans. And he didn't play over 2,000 league minutes until he was 24 in his second season at Newcastle. So with Tielemans, there are a ton of minutes in those legs. And he's slow. And he adds nothing defensively. I think adding Santos and Tielemans helps hugely in ball progression through the middle. It means that Bruno doesn't need to come quite as deep to get on the ball. He can stay in more dangerous positions. But my concern with the stable of midfielders that United have, including Mainoo, including Ugarte when he's fit again, who is the defensive ball winner there? There really isn't one. As like a huge Casemiro level, like defensive six. I'm concerned.
Santos had really big ball winning numbers in France.
Yeah, Liga.
But yeah, I mean, like, that, I guess that is a concern. Though I would say that, like, you press a bit better from the front, you get more combative out of the back. Like, it does look like they're looking for fullbacks as well, which can help a bit too. I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying. But I think, yeah, I guess that if you have Santos, Tielemans and Bruno playing in midfield, or God forbid, if there's a game where you play Mainoo, Tielemans, Bruno, ball is going to go a lot.
This, like, is the thing. I just don't see who's coming and mopping up as a six in front of the back four.
Lisandro Martinez.
Yeah, I think it helps. Well, the thing is, when he was signed, I kind of figured he might be a DM or a left back, not a centre back. But
if you had a more, this isn't really a diss at Carrick. If you had a more adventurous coach, I think that's probably something we'd see. Right? Like, Arsenal were interested in Lisandro Martinez before United got him, and Arsenal went and got Zinchenko. And then Zinchenko was stepping into midfield, and you were like, oh, that was the plan here. And Lisandro Martinez can do that, like, give you the progressive passing out of midfield, like, not to the Zinchenko levels, but to a good level, but he's much more combative on the ball.
I mean, that
I guess is a question, though I do think you've got guys who can, like, work pretty hard, guys like Ahmad, you know, going to help out. You've also got Rashford coming back, I assume, who could give you some minutes. Like, that's better than having, like, Dorgu be your backup winger, I think.
But then Šeško, what do you do with Dorgu then?
Šeško, you've got to play him as a fullback at some point.
No, he's never played as a fullback under Carrick. He's never started in a competitive game.
He's still very young, though. He is still very young.
But I just think that the decision has been made that if he's going to play, he's going to play as a winger.
Yeah, okay.
The issue is it's going to be Luke Shaw left back or a repurposed right back.
Carrick's not going to be there. Carrick's not going to be there for that long.
Yeah, fair.
Like the worry about Carrick from a United point of view is that Carrick might not do badly enough to get fired.
Well, so this is
because I think Carrick is like Carrick's a pretty competent coach, right?
Yeah,
he's not going to embarrass you. But that means he doesn't get fired because it's quite hard to just fire a guy who's doing okay.
I've said this so much about United that the progression and development of them back to an elite squad, an elite team, has been hampered by the fact that they've been able to fail upwards time and time again.
Hmm.
They've been able, like Solskjaer or whoever the manager is, have been able to win like a League Cup or an FA Cup in one every two seasons, even though the team is falling apart or reliant entirely on Bruno Fernandes for creative output, but they failed upwards just enough to justify another season. That is where I feel kind of Carrick's probably going to go.
Yeah.
He's going to do fine. He might get fifth and there might be five Champions League spots again. And it's like, well, he got Champions League.
Yeah. And then there might be like an Aston Villa job in his future. You know, sure. Like that's that type of thing. Maybe not Villa. They're a bit too high at the moment. But you know that kind of thing. Look, in the end, I look at United and I'm like, you're a little bit thin.
Yeah.
You are lacking a bit of stardust. Your best player is a year older.
32.
I do think they'll go and get some fullbacks. I presume they're going to go and get another forward. The rumours they wanted Tchouaméni as well. So if they still plan to add another midfielder, then that helps.
Yeah, I'd love Tchouaméni. Be class.
Well, I don't think it's going to happen now. Rodri's not going to Real Madrid, right? But
oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
It's hard to imagine United doing something that makes me drastically reconsider their position.
I think they need to do multiple things across 2 to 3 windows to really...
This season.
Yeah, no, that's what I mean. Like, it's like... Yeah. Even we're, 12th of August now, so there is a few weeks left of the window. There's too much work for them to do to be truly transformative, enough for them to not be a best fourth, but still in this bottom tier.
Yeah. Okay, so they're in fifth for us. In fourth, I've got Liverpool.
I've got Liverpool too.
Okay, so Liverpool, this is like a qualified fourth in that I am really excited about Liverpool. I think there's a chance that they look phenomenal. You know, I think that they're building a really interesting squad. It looks like they're going to add Barcola, who I think is a great fit for Iraola Ball. I think that a lot of the weaknesses, such as they are in the squad, are helped by Iraola. On the other hand, there are problems there that I think are going to be difficult to manage. Like, Iraola plays a very intense style of football. Iraola has not had to balance Champions League and league before. Iraola also asks a lot of his centre-backs... You know, when it comes to like building play out of the back, Iraola has some questions as well about like rest defense and how this team manages games defensively. Mm-hmm. Like, we were talking about this on the transfer flow recently, but part of the issue is that like Bournemouth were very good in attack, but they were not very good in defense. They gave up an awful lot defensively while creating an attack. And part of it is because the fullbacks are just empowered to go and join the attack.
Yeah.
So often you're watching them and you're seeing like a 2-1-7 or something.
Yeah,
you know, like
yeah.
It's like there are so many guys getting forward. And that's great.
Until it's not.
Yeah, until it's not. For Liverpool, the question is, will the talent... Can they send fewer guys forward and the talent of the guys they have will be enough to get through? Or, you know, the movements they're doing or whatever, will that be enough? Or are they going to try and send this number of guys forward? Because if they do, that's going to ask a lot of these defenders, and they're going to have a child in defence and Virgil van Dijk, who's incredibly old. So I just think that the press is going to have to be phenomenal to make it work, and it's going to take some tweaks. And
time as well.
And so at the beginning of the season, if the press is really rolling, then they may look really good and then maybe drop off a bit once fitness levels drop. Or we may see it the opposite way around, where they start the season, it's a little bit ropey because people are still learning their roles. And then about halfway through the season, they really start rolling. Either way, I can see Liverpool putting together a really good half season. I can see Liverpool smashing some teams and, like, honestly, battering some big teams. I can see this team being amazing. Because you're like, this is a team that's still going to roll out. What, like, Isak, Barcola, Wirtz, Munoz, or something in attack, Szoboszlai in midfield with Havertz, but like it's gonna have a good 11, though questions about the fullbacks.
And
this is gonna be a good team. But what I can't really imagine is them putting together 38 quality games. There's going to be runs in there where I think they are pretty shocky. Pretty shoddy, rather.
I am slightly less bullish on Liverpool. I think they have the potential to be absolutely outstanding from 8 onwards. The vast majority of my questions lie from 6 backwards. And all of these question marks and issues are all the same issues that we spoke about last season and probably the season before that. There is no out-and-out 6, like a truly natural 6. They don't have any fullbacks, like defensive fullbacks anymore. Robertson's gone.
They've just added Araujo, who might see some right back minutes.
Incredibly injury prone.
I like Bradley. I think Iraola
also injured. Bradley is long term injured, as far as I know. So Frimpong is going to be the starting right back there, who is not a right back. Then you have Virgil van Dijk, who's 35. Jacques already injured. Leone is a child. So basically, you've got a 35-year-old
and coming off an ACL.
Yeah, and you've got a 35-year-old Virgil van Dijk who's somehow not gone off a cliff yet. He's hanging on. You're squeezing the dregs out of VVD. You've got a ton of injured players already before the season starts and attacking wing-backs pretending to be full-backs. And you're coming into a system under Iraola, which is super intense and super physically demanding of a team that's already thin in certain really important positions over a 38-game season plus Champions League. I don't think they have quality and depth enough in certain positions to actually be that good this season. I think the wheels will come off at some stage, either just from a system point of view, but I think mostly caused from a physical standpoint. If they're coming in already injured, if Iraola plays the way that we know he is likely to play and the intensity he wants, that's so taxing on a squad who's going to play 45 games minimum, probably 50 this season. Also, if you look at the Champions League, they play more games than ever now. I think the intensity across a 45 plus game season for a squad that's already thin and already injured, I think it asks too much, and I think the wheels come off enough for them to fall away from, certainly away from the title race, and I think away from third as well.
Yeah, I kind of agree. But I still think they're going to be good. And I think the wheels coming off probably does look like, worst case, like fifth.
I think they'll be Champions but it's League, so.
But you look at the teams around, and I'm just like, well, somebody here is going to be really good. Somebody here will be pretty good. It's hard. The Liverpool title here, I think, is hard to see. But you know, who knows? Maybe. But there are lots of people trying to talk themselves into it because they're like, I'm not convinced by City. I'm not convinced by Arsenal. It's like, yeah, well, you can be unconvinced by those teams, but you've got to account for Liverpool's own problems.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. Unconvinced by them, but convinced by Liverpool.
If Liverpool go and get like a top draw right back, I have no idea where that would come from. But if Liverpool go and get a top draw right back before the end of the window, that would change. That would change it a bit. That would probably push them closer, you know, up more towards like second, third. But I still think that there are going to be teething problems.
I think it all relies on that. Like, that forward stable of players is outstanding on paper, especially like more so if you add Barkley as well, like truly outstanding. But they didn't click that well last season, and we haven't seen them in competitive games properly click yet. So I think their potential ceiling is super high going forward. I need to see it first to then say, okay, I think you got a chance to third, I think you got a chance to second.
Okay, so now we've got Chelsea, City and Arsenal.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have all these kind of clustered together?
No, I have one and then most likely two above that, and in a two, just to try and create some semblance of a title race.
Who's the one then?
Chelsea.
So Chelsea below.
Chelsea third.
See,
I think it's an interesting scenario with Chelsea this season because
I'm feeling, I don't know.
You're a toss-up between them and City, I guess.
I find it very hard to pick. I think, okay, maybe we should just take these three like together. If I look at it, I think like, try and be objective. I think Arsenal should be favourites.
Yeah, I agree.
Arsenal are the most stable of these teams, which was exactly what we said last year. I think there's a perception that Arsenal have had like a really bad window because of missing out on Vinny. And there might be somebody else in there I'm forgetting, but he's basically missing out on Vinny. But if you look at the Arsenal squad, it's not hugely different. Like the big issue for Arsenal is not who they haven't signed. The issue is who's going to be fit. Mm-hmm. So Saliba missing time, months, like that's a concern.
Yeah.
How quickly are Rice and Saka back in the team? you know, and playing regularly. What does Saka look like when he's back? These are questions. Like, those are reasonable questions.
Is Timber injured as well?
He's injured at the moment. They said he's weeks away, but, you know, like, probably means he's back by October. But that's also a worry.
Yeah.
So I just look at the Arsenal situation and I think, yeah, this is a little bit thin. But I do think Arsenal would do something defensively. They'll get somebody in to help out that group who can either play right back or can play centre back. Like, they'll do something there. And also Arsenal's defence, like, as much as Saliba, I do think, is the best centre back in the world, like, Arsenal are the best defensive team in the world.
Yeah.
And they're not just going to become a not good defensive team without Saliba. Like, they defend well because they defend collectively, right? They're good at all the defensive stuff.
Yeah.
So they're not going to be a disaster. Trossard's gone, Solis has come in, and then Bruno G is like a big signing. It's a big signing, because that is a guy who, when you don't have Rice, Bruno G can pair with other people and work really well. Because he gives you more defensive stuff than you would expect from an attacking midfielder. He gives you more creativity than you would expect from a central midfielder. Like, he's very useful. And when Rice comes back, having Bruno plus Rice plus another kind of forward-thinking midfielder, that's going to help Arsenal's attacking issues a lot, I think, even if you don't improve the stable of wingers.
Yeah.
But there are questions. There's the Saliba thing. I think if Martinelli goes and they don't get in a top left winger, the team is light on pace.
I don't think that happens though, right? Do you think that happens? Do you think they let him go without having a replacement?
They could get a replacement though who doesn't offer the same top end speed. Mm. And then you look around the Arsenal team and you're like, who's really, really fast in this team?
I'd say Saka's the fastest, but he's lost pace.
Yeah. So you're like, if Martinelli goes, you've got a bunch of guys who are like, they're not slow,
but they're not fast.
But no one's really fast, which is a bit of a problem. So there's that. There's the right back question. There's the Saliba question. Like, these are all things. So if Arsenal go out and buy a left winger, depending who it is, you know, if they go buy like Marcus Rashford, okay, don't love it. If they want to get like Ndjai, I'm kind of Ndjai curious. I'm kind of interested in that. Yeah. But like, again, not super fast. And again, you know, like, not going to be a superstar. Like, he's a good player. If they went and got Yildiz, I don't think that's going to happen. But if they went and got Yildiz, I'd be like, amazing. Like, because honestly, when we were talking about wingers for Arsenal this summer, I was like, if Vinny's available, Vinny's number one. But number two for me probably would be Yildiz. Like, I think he's basically the perfect profile for what Arsenal wants.
So
he's already amazing and he's likely to become world class. Because I don't think he wants to leave Juve.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Juve did go out.
I mean, it's
out.
A pretty easy sell to like come into the best, the team that's most likely to win the Premier League, and
sure,
we got the Champions League final last year.
But it might not be an easy sell if you're a Juventus fan, you're playing for Juventus, and like, you're wearing like Del Piero's number or whatever. Like, I agree that it's possible. And Juventus did go and spend a fortune on an 18-year-old left winger this summer. Like, they spent like over 30 million on him, Alibegovic from Leverkusen.
Big money for Serie A as well.
So they were obviously thinking about like what's the plan there? You've got to have to get him minutes. But Yildiz, I think, would be the perfect player. So if Arsenal went and got him, I'd say, okay, great, fine, not worried. There's also the fact that, as we talked about last season, Arsenal very injured, and guys like Eze and Incapié didn't really look... Incapié looked good defensively, but they didn't look like fully themselves, those players, last season. And I do think that a year on, build some relationships, get some stability in the team, and you probably get a little bit more out of those kinds of people. And also, you don't know, having won the title would hopefully mean... Like, there were games last season that under normal circumstances would have been easy 3 points for Arsenal, right? Like, Wolves away. The only reason that Arsenal coughed up points and Wolves away was because they knew they could win the title and they were shit scared, right? Yeah. They're not going to shit themselves in a game like that in January, February this season, because who cares? Like, it's fine. It's not that big a deal. They know that they've been there and done it. I think those kind of points will come back because they only went because Arsenal were bottling it. So I go up and down on it. But to me, what this really comes down to is, what are they doing defensively to cover for Saliba? And what are they doing in attack? Like, I really like Solis. I think he looks great. It's not enough. If they go and get a top-class left winger, even if they get Ndjai, then I'll say, okay, I think that's positive. But if they go... Because, like, let's look at it. Like, Trossard, they just won the league with Trossard. Trossard was a kind of bargain basement January signing that we liked at the time, but it was a 20 million signing from Brighton. And he was fantastic for Arsenal. But if they went and got a Yildiz, then I'd say, like, even if they tried to, if they beat Liverpool to Barkala, which I don't think will happen, I don't think Barkala is the perfect fit for Arsenal. He's a better fit for Liverpool. But again, you'd say, okay, like, this is a big addition. So to me, I look at these teams and I think, with my totally rational head on, if I've got kind of 1A, B and C, then Arsenal are 1A.
Yeah, I agree. I'm slightly more bullish on Arsenal just because I think they're the one team coming into the season that can pretty much roll on from last season seamlessly.
Sure.
And keep doing the same thing. They haven't gone through a big reset. They haven't changed a manager. They haven't lost, you know, like, big leaders in the club like Salah and Robertson. And they're not changing system. They are the same squad, minus Trossard. Key members retained, same manager, same system. They are very, very far down this project road now. It is business as usual. And even without the Vinicius signing, they were good enough to win the Premier League last season. And in my opinion, they're a better team this season just by adding Bunerji. Like that, like the opportunities that opens up are huge. You know, like you say, rotation-wise, like Rice, Bruno Odegaard, I think would be everyone fit, my first choice. But you can also play Zubimendi, Bruno, Rice if you want to be really conservative. Zubimendi, Bruno, Odegaard if you need to rest Rice. Like, you can even play Zubimendi with Lewis Skelly and Eze for like a really rotated, heavy week or whatever, you know, roll him out in the Carabao Cup. There are so many options.
You want Marino as well.
Yeah, you can play, he can get minutes there as well. So I think that opens up a huge amount of rotation. And there were so many points last season where it felt like they had to play Rice for every single minute of every game that he was fit for. Because they didn't really have another option. And if they didn't play him, it was such a big downgrade that it felt like they would be too vulnerable and to dropping points, I guess. So I think Arsenal are a better version of what they were last season. I think the teams around them competing for the title or competing for the European spots are at best less stable, at worst worse than last season. So for me, just from like a rational point of view, if Arsenal are better and all the other teams are either worse or just more unstable or more transitiony, why is it not same again this season? Why is it not run it back, Arsenal win back-to-back titles? I think Arsenal have probably the most balanced squad in the league. Their depth is really good. Their individual quality, I think, is one of the best. And you look at now the rotation options they have in most positions. Okay, maybe you can add an elite left winger, but Solis coming in. Is Solis an upgrade on Trossard, or like at least tantamount to Trossard's output or influence? I think you can feasibly say that he is likely, yes, at worst, like a like-for-like replacement. And you won the league with Trossard scoring 6 goals and Martinelli scoring 1. Like, you also won the league with Gyökeres not really firing and Havertz playing good minutes but also not scoring a ton, and Marino potentially looking as like the most dangerous 9 out of those 3 at points in last season. It was an imperfect squad build in terms of traditional like elite left winger, elite goal scoring 9. But Arsenal were the best team in the league last season and they won the league rightly so. And I think the other teams around them are not as good as they were last season or have the potential to be worse just because they're less stable. Arsenal just need to continue business as usual with slightly more firepower to pull from with some of their signings.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so I agree. Like, if I were, you know, a bookie, then I'd be like, Arsenal are our favourites. But there's a part of me that thinks, can Chelsea do something?
Interesting.
It's a huge amount of turnover for Chelsea.
Yeah.
You know, we're looking at a new left wing back, new right wing back. They've brought in some old guys to help out a little bit. Obviously, completely new system. Morgan Rodgers is going to be starting for them. No idea what they're going to do up front. I assume it's going to be Pedro, Rodgers, Palmer in a front three.
Yeah, it's like a 3-4-2-1.
Still some questions about the back three, but it's fine. But I do look at it and I think Alonso is a really good coach.
Mm-hmm.
I think Rodgers is a massive overpay. But Rodgers is a talented player. And I do think that Rodgers, Pedro, Palmer all dovetails together really
Rodgers
nicely.
Rodgers as a runner, Palmer as a creator. Yeah. It works. Yeah.
And then like Enzo Caicedo in midfield. It's like...
With Lavi on the bench.
That is really strong. Really strong. And they're not going to have European football. So it's one game a week. They've got to try and be good, which even they should be able to do. And the squad is so deep that you can... Like, okay, Palestra... At right wing back, their options are James, Gusto, Palestra, and Giovanni Quenda. All 4 of those. That's nuts. I mean, I assume somebody's going to go, but this is what the squad is. The squad is so deep all over the show. Like, it's actually insane. Even at left wing back, they're going to be choosing presumably between Barco and Chavarria. Like, it's pretty good. So I just kind of look at Chelsea and think there is totally a world where this team flies because they're so fresh and because a bunch of these guys just need direction. And to me, the real question, like what it ultimately comes down to, is how good is Palmer this season? Because we've had two seasons of Palmer, right? One, he was incredible. Looked like one of the best players in the league. Looked maybe like one of the best players in the world. Then last season, he was okay. He was pretty good.
He was in a night with injury as well.
Sure, but that's part of how good.
It's a factor,
but
yeah,
even
yeah.
But even when he played, he wasn't playing like Palmer from the previous year at all. You know, like, okay, Saka, for example, last season, people were looking at Saka's numbers last year, and I was like, man, when Saka's on the field, Saka's been phenomenal. Like, if you actually look at the stats when Saka was on the pitch,
yes, like he was amazing.
The problem with Saka is that he was just never on the pitch. Yeah. Like, that's the issue. We can all say, oh, he looks like he's lost a step and, you know, he's not scoring anymore. But if you actually look at his underlying numbers, he was pretty fucking good.
For such a limited minute, yeah.
Palmer last season just looked not as good as he looked the season before. If Palmer this season looks the way he did in his first year, honestly, the sky's the limit for Chelsea. And I don't know why, in a way, I'd put them above. Well, I guess I'd put them above City as... I don't know if I'd put them above City. If you just said, who's likeliest to finish higher, I would probably say City. Mm-hmm. But if you said, who's likelier to win the title, I'd probably say Chelsea.
It okay, feels a little I kind of get that.
Because it feels like with Chelsea, there's more boom or bust, right? Whereas
it's
with City, I'm like, City will be good. But I do look at... But again, with City, I might as well go into City. My issues are, Maresca's a downgrade on Pep.
Mm-hmm.
That team has been the Rodri team for years, and it's now going to be the Elliot Anderson team. That is a big, big change.
Yeah,
to completely change the engine room. Like imagine if we said to you, if we said, right, well, you know, Arsenal have like added loads of really good players, but like that they've lost Declan Rice and they're replacing him with Elliot Anderson. Then we'd say, ooh, okay, our stability argument completely goes out the window.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though we like Anderson. And that's where I am. Like, I think Doku's fantastic. I think Haaland's fantastic. At the same time, I'm kind of like, is they've still got to defend. This team's still got to learn to defend. Yeah. And I don't quite know what the plan is there because Pep couldn't quite work it out. So is the plan going to be like, if Boadi comes in, is it going to be Boadi Anderson? Is it going to be Anderson, Nico O'Reilly? Like, who's the defensive presence in the midfield?
Mm-hmm.
Because Anderson's not a defensive midfielder.
And who's the metronomic passer that's replacing Rodri if you're going to play big possession ball?
Yeah, are you going to say, okay, well, Cherki is now going to be the hub that everything revolves around?
He's going to control the game.
Well, you can say, can he develop into that? Or can somebody like Foden do it the way that Bernardo Silva used to help out with it? Like, who can do it? But there are loads of people saying this Maresca arriving is going to unlock Cherki. And it's like, okay, put Cherki in the 11. How does this team defend?
Mm-hmm.
And we're still exactly where we've been for ages, which is like, there aren't that many guys in this team who are just straight up good defenders. On the other hand, they've got Doku and Haaland and Anderson. Like, they're up to their balls in talent. So, like, they will be good. And they totally could win the league. But I think, you know, if you said to me, okay, how many... If we run 100 simulations, how many of those does City finish lower than, you know, lower than second or third? But lower than third, then I might say, I don't know, like, 8. How many do they win the league? Like, 10? I don't know. Chelsea, I'd say maybe there are like 15 where they win the league.
But there are like 20 where they finish
below third. Yeah, exactly. So it's just like, it's kind of that argument that people used to make about why more men got firsts than women.
I've not heard this.
Where it was just like, well, and anecdotally, I would say this was true, which is all the women I knew had prepared for their exams.
Oh, sure, And
they were going to do pretty well.
Yeah, yeah.
But they were going to make sure they answered the questions and they weren't really going to take risks. And I knew far more men who were just like, I just decided to answer a question that I hadn't prepared at all because I just thought that I had something to say. And some of them would fuck it up and get a 2-2 or a third, and others would get a first. And I was like, you do need a little bit of risk-taking.
Yeah. In every single university exam, I got every single past paper I could. Worked out the likelihood the questions or topics came up, and only say you had to answer 2 questions. I prepared 3 in the hope that 2 of them would come up. In one instance, 0 came up.
Wow.
And it was politics, though. Like, so it was fucking, it was fine.
Yeah, it's a fucking piece of piss, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, more balls to the wall risk taking.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, that's where Chelsea totally have that capacity to just like fly. And in the stretches of the season where the transition is bumpy. So like this beginning bit of the season where City might be adjusting, Chelsea shouldn't really be. Even though they've got a new manager and everything, I think the new manager is going to improve, make things easier for them. And in stretches of the season where the Champions League is getting really tough and everyone's like, Jesus, we are exhausted. Mm-hmm. In, you know, the doldrums in November, Chelsea will be like fit as a fiddle.
Yeah.
You know, like we're ready to go. All we've got to do is just get these fucking games won.
So you know? I think the biggest gift that this Chelsea squad has inherited is being as unreliable and poor as they were last season. Finishing 10th, miles off it. Because the Rosnier era was so poor that it allows Alonso just to rip it up and start again. Whereas I feel with City and Liverpool, a little bit less so with Liverpool, but with City and Liverpool, those managers are coming in trying to adapt and tweak already successful teams. So I think there's a limit to how much they're willing to rock the boat. Whereas Rosnier, Alonso can come in and just do what he wants. Because we'd be like, well, we fucking finished 10th last year. We're starting again. And the biggest thing is he gets a week. Like he's basically got 38 games to prepare for. Disregarding the domestic cups, he's got 38 games to prepare for this season. That's it. And most weeks he'll have a full week to train and prepare for the Saturday or Sunday game or whatever, whichever way it falls. That is a huge advantage on all of the other teams in Champions League. Huge advantage on Manchester United trying to cobble together a decent Premier League season and compete in the Champions League against the best clubs in the world when they are a middling top club. Oh, like Liverpool still trying to find their feet, also having relentless week in, week out Champions League. City should have an easier time, but still not perfect. And Arsenal should be fine. They've done it before. They got the whole way to the final. They're a little bit injury prone, but sure. That's a huge advantage that Chelsea have, that extra rest. And if you look at historically, generally those scenarios have been favourable for those teams that have expected to finish in European spots, but not the season after they haven't. So for example, 15-16 season, Chelsea finished 10th with 50 points. Conte came in 16-17, won the league with 93 points. Liverpool back in 12-13 went from 7th to 2nd in 13-14 on 84 points, finishing 2 behind City. A good team with a good squad and a good manager playing one game a week for the majority of the season is a huge advantage.
Well, look at Man United back half of last season, right?
Yeah.
Man United were just rolling because they were just fresher than everybody, but they just looked fresher than everybody. You could see it on the field.
If you have a game on Wednesday night and you're getting back Thursday morning, or you're flying straight back Thursday night from somewhere in Europe, and then your India game Saturday 2 p.m. or 3 p.m. kickoff, that's tough doing that week in, week out against, I don't know, Bayern Munich, PSG, Dortmund, whoever, midweek, and then going away to Anfield on the weekend and then going back to Dortmund for the second leg the week after. Like it is so tough and it's so relentless. Add in the domestic cups as well. So I think Chelsea's biggest advantage is the fact that they just have significantly less games. And if Alonso, who is a very intelligent, smart manager, if he can get them ticking and get enough out of his biggest players, I think they could be really dangerous this season. I think they're most likely finished third. I have them down as third just because I think they're too much of an unknown. I think City, there are unknowns with Maresca, but Maresca does, his betting in process, I don't think will be that volatile compared to like Iriola's, for example, because there's not a huge shift there. Maresca has spent time in the City camp before. I think there isn't a huge change from what they've had before to what they are. I think the biggest issue is that Pep has left in an enormous vacuum. And in many ways, I think Maresca is kind of inheriting a bit of a poison chalice in that he's inheriting much of Pep's expectations or the expectations applied to Pep, but without Pep's quality. And we don't really know the true value of Guardiola. Like, we don't know how many points Pep is worth per season. Like, individually, just having Pep as your manager, how many points is that worth a season? Is it 5? Is it 10? We don't necessarily know, but if it's 5 or 10, like, that's the difference between being in a title race and being in a race for top four.
Yeah,
the way I look at it is the difference.
It took Pep a long time to work something out last season. Like a long time, right?
Yeah.
Everyone kept saying they'll work it out and then they'll start rolling. And it actually kind of never really happened until after the EFL Cup final. That was how long it took. Well, I just think that when the guy trying to work something out is Maresca, it's going to take three or four more games than it would with Pep, and his solution probably won't be quite as good.
It won't be as good, yeah.
And so then you're like you say, that's okay, you drop points in one or two of those games. If those games end up being tough, if you've got Champions League fixtures as well to prepare for, it's a really difficult situation. So yeah, I think Maresca's like an okay manager. I don't really think he's great or anything, but City could totally win the league. If you make me bet on where they finish, I bet on second, like you say. But it also wouldn't surprise me if there's just some stretch in the middle of the season where, for example, they have a serious injury, like a Doku or a Haaland injury or something like that, or Gvardiol, and or Anderson, and Maresca just has absolutely no fucking clue what to do about it. Yeah. And it's also not like they are stacked in every position either. Like, what is the right back situation for them?
So defensively, there's questions. I think they're stacked going forward. I think defensively, they are quite light.
They're not stacked if Haaland gets injured.
Well, this is it. Okay, so I
take,
do think that,
okay, here's
so,
the thing.
So
take,
I think they have loads of end players there.
There's the only player from the only two players from Arsenal who you can injure and completely fuck them over are Rice and Saliba. And we're going to see what, and I think they'll be okay with Saliba and Rice. They've gone and got Bruno. Who in the attack can you take out and fuck Arsenal over? Like, literally nobody. They had Saka. They were without Saka for like most of last season, and they won the league. Like, whereas with City, I'm like, take Haaland out, take Doku out, you are left with a really bad situation.
I mean, you got
take
Turkey,
Anderson
you got,
out.
You got Semenya, you got Foden, you got Marmoush. Like, there are good players there.
I'm not saying they're not good players, but you've gone from probably the best attack in the league to like.
But I think that's
Man United, slightly below Man United level attack.
I think that's a systemic issue in that everything goes to Haaland. They're so Haaland dependent. So if Haaland goes down, they're like, shit, what is plan B? That's where I have questions about Maresca and what would his solution be in that scenario? Because I don't even think Pep had a solution if Haaland went down.
But
I
do think Pep would have worked something out.
Pep would have been like,
okay, we will figure something out. Whereas with Maresca, I'm just like, I think Maresca would be like... Then we finish fourth.
I don't know if this is necessarily like an argument, but from my perspective, removing Haaland is more of an issue because of the system that has been built around him versus Haaland going out and them not having enough players around him to fill the gaps. They have very, very good attacking players. I think it's just the system that has materialized partially through the fault of Haaland being as good as he is, so heavily relies on Haaland's output that once removed, the vacuum that leaves makes it very, very difficult to fill in the same way. You can't plug somebody else in. You can't plug Marmoush in and expect him to play the same way that Haaland does and to create the same chances in the same way that Haaland does. It doesn't work like that.
No.
So we haven't really seen a plan B. That doesn't necessarily mean there isn't one, but I think the issue is more of a systemic issue with Haaland in that it's too Haaland focused rather than them not having enough attacking entities to be like, we can still have potentially the second best attack in the league. We just need to reconfigure some things.
But I think we're kind of saying the same thing. Like, I just think that there are more single points of failure for City than there are for Arsenal.
Oh no, I fully agree. I think Arsenal are the comfortably safest bet, and I think they'll win the title. I think City will most likely finish second. I think Chelsea third, and then a gap to Liverpool and United.
I wouldn't bet on Arsenal winning the title in that you would favour the field over Arsenal, right? Like, as in...
I know, there's so much unstable, but there's so much...
Arsenal, you have to give Arsenal less than 50% chance to win the league. And that's what we're saying. I'm saying Arsenal versus someone else... Someone else is more likely to win the title, and I would say significantly so. Like, I would give Arsenal a 30% chance
but
of winning the league.
They're the team most likely to win the title.
They're the team most likely to win the title, but a team other than Arsenal is more likely to win the title than Arsenal.
Yeah, but is that what we're arguing?
No, I'm just saying that, like, I wouldn't bet on Arsenal to win the league.
I think I would.
If you made me bet on a team, I would bet on Arsenal.
Yeah, sure.
But I wouldn't bet on Arsenal to win the league because I don't think they're that likely to win the league. I think they're probably like 35% to win the league.
I think there's enough instability.
I think then you get,
the rest of the
City,
teams.
20 for City, 20 for Chelsea, 15 for Liverpool.
I think there's in real terms, outside of probability alone, there's enough instability around the other teams competing with Arsenal to make me pretty bullish on Arsenal that if they're able to just stay the course, then I don't see a world where I guess there are so many teams. I just don't see another team keeping pace with them across 38 games.
All right, man. Well, that's our take on the Premier League title race. We'll see how it goes. For now, let's open up the burn book. All right, Pete, burn book, what have you got for me today?
Let's start with what's going in the burn book. What I'm going to put in the burn book this week are fully electric cars. So I agree that the world should be exploring more sustainable methods of energy and fuel and all that. I agree this is like, it's objectively a good decision to try and use less fossil fuel. But I do not think that the technology or infrastructure is there for loads of people to have fully electric vehicles yet. And this became clear to me when we were driving through France early last month. The whole trip was about 1,100 miles there and back. And obviously, doing that amount of driving, you have to stop along the way, petrol stations, give Bonnie a break, all of that stuff. You're stopping every couple of hours. And you'd pull into a service station. But so many of these service stations in France that you kind of, you pull off the motorway and you end up on this little like narrow one-way road that funnels you into where the petrol station is and then the parking for the kind of services. And it's a little one-way road. There's no overtaking. You're all single file. And you would get into these and it would be absolutely fucking chaos because four or five bays in the car park would be dedicated to like these fast charging electric vehicle bays.
Sure.
But even the fastest charging, like the most sophisticated chargers of these, take like 15 to 30 minutes to take a car from 10% to 80%. And there's only four or five of them in any of these services, if any. So what that means was, like, imagine if you go to the petrol station to fill up your car with petrol and you pull up at the pump and you're pumping for 30 minutes. Imagine the backlog that you would have waiting behind you. Filling up a full tank of petrol takes under 5 minutes, probably 3 minutes. And the issue that this created that we saw multiple service stations was that so many people have electric vehicles now and they're doing these long trips in the motorway through France. Like, we're in the middle of France. Like, there's no reason to be there unless you're going somewhere else. And they can't risk, like, oh, we'll just go to the next one because their range isn't that good. Their range isn't the same as like an actual combustion engine. And also there's no guarantee that the next service station they get to will have chargers or anything. There's a whole labyrinth of issues that they need to deal with just by having fully electric cars. That petrol, like, you get like a worst case scenario for a petrol combustion engine, you can carry a jerry can if you really want, and that will get you another 40 miles. You cannot do that with an EV. But the issue was is that these little EVs would pull up and they'd plug in and they'd be there for 30 minutes per bay. So the next EV would come, wouldn't be a booth or a bay, so they'd sit and wait, and then the next one and the next one. And it meant that this little tail started backing out into the one-way road, which then stopped everybody else getting in to the petrol station or services. So it created this traffic jam of people waiting, electric vehicles waiting for the bays, and they were waiting for like 20 minutes. And it was just three or four times we went to these service stations and just saw the same thing, just a queue of electric vehicles disrupting the flow of traffic, making people like really try and navigate around this fucking obstacle course just to get into the car park or just to get into the petrol station to put petrol in the car. And for me, it just showed that there isn't enough infrastructure there and the cars don't have enough range for it to be fully functional for long journeys. My biggest problem with this is, or my biggest gripe with this is that the perfect scenario in this world is a car that utilizes electric energy for short drives when it doesn't need to use loads of petrol and you know that you're not going too far from your house and you're not getting up to high speed. But for long journeys or when it feels like it's really draining the battery, it kicks in a combustion engine which is filled with petrol. This would be transformative technology if it hadn't been invented like fucking 20 years ago in hybrid cars. Like the perfect balance already exists that we use less petrol but we use electric when needed or when we can, but to actually get good range and not have to wait 30 minutes in a queue just to get in the bay and then another 30 minutes just to charge to 80% and then go another 300 kilometers and you needed to stop again and charge. We had this technology already and I think the push for EV, I understand it, but I think the infrastructure isn't there for it to be rolled out like actually functionally usable and not just really laborious and long and also affecting everybody around each other. I don't know about the science of it or the actual technological standpoint of this potential solution. This could be, I've not done any research on it, so this could be dumb in that, or just not dumb, but just not functional at all. If they had removable batteries, like a universal battery, every EV car had, in the same way that every new phone has USB-C, a universal battery, all of the manufacturers align saying everybody has the same battery and they're removable, there's maybe three or four of them and you can remove them. Pull up to the petrol station, pop one out, put it in the charger, take one out that's charged, put it in and drive off. Pay whatever you pay. And then somebody else comes back and takes your one that was in your car when it's fully charged. Mm-hmm. For me, that's the only way that this works. Because unless you're going to dramatically increase how quick it is to charge from 10 to 80%, if you can't get under 10 minutes, I just don't see how it works at scale.
Yeah, I don't know about the charging, but I do think they'll be able to improve, obviously, the battery storage.
Yeah.
Like in the last...
The range, yeah.
Like we always talk about how over the last, you know, 30 years or whatever, the like our ability to make chips and our transistor technology and all that kind of stuff, like all those things have advanced.
Mm-hmm.
But in the last like 10, 15 years, the way that our battery technology has advanced has been similar, right? Like it's really, really quickly got a lot better.
I do think that curve eases off though, just naturally over time. I think you get to a point where there is little else to gain.
Maybe.
Like you hit a ceiling.
Maybe, but it doesn't need to improve forever. It just needs to improve to the point that it's good enough. Or if places, or it can be a thing where it's like, okay, like newer EVs are fitted with like solar panel roofs that absorb that.
Sweden have motorways that charge your car as you drive on. Yeah. There's loads of stuff like that.
Yeah, like piezoelectric stuff. Yeah, there's all kinds of stuff like that. I don't think it takes that much to get this viable.
I agree, but I don't.
But
think
I do understand
viable.
The argument that, like, currently it's difficult.
It's fine if not that many people have them, but there's a huge wave now where loads of people have fully electric cars, and the infrastructure for charging and dealing with them and getting them from A to B without them running out just isn't there for me.
Sure, I understand. Right, what am I putting in the burn book? If you listen to any podcast now, you are going to get an advert for VPN, right?
That's been like that for years.
It's been like that for years. But we are now in the situation where, like, you kind of have to have a VPN. It sucks. Well,
for certain things, yeah, you absolutely have to.
If you want to watch porn, you have to have a VPN.
Yeah. You have to go to the Netherlands or Germany.
I'm sorry, but that's fucking mental. Like, the fact that we're in a situation now where you can be in a...
Unless you want
modern,
to put in your...
You could be in a modern, technologically advanced country. Even then, though, some porn would like not be available. Right? Like, some websites are just straight up not available in the UK.
Oh, really?
Because, again, we've talked about this in the past, but rules around the internet are made by people who don't use the internet. They think the internet is just like for email. And so they're like, well, why do people need to be talking online? Why would anyone need to do that? Shut the fuck up. Like, yeah. That's how things work now. You shouldn't have to have a VPN to look at porn. I'm sorry, but you shouldn't. Porn should be available for the people. Like, truly, I just think it's like, I mean, maybe I just sound like those people who are kind of saying, you know, why shouldn't we be allowed to smoke indoors when they banned indoor smoking? But I think porn is like a completely normal commodity that people use. We may not kind of like the idea that people use it, but they do. And people have sexual urges, and that's not like wrong. It's okay for them to want to look at porn, and making it impossible to do all this stuff, or making it so it's like very onerous, so onerous that people don't really do it, or they have to find a legal workaround, to me just seems like it's replacing one problem with another problem, or replacing a half problem with a bigger problem. You know, like now you might be in a situation where in the past, like I would say like 3-4 years ago, a very small percentage of people you knew had a VPN, you know, like a paid VPN.
Yeah.
And now I would say that most people probably do, like almost most, like certainly most men under 30 do.
Yeah, I mean, we did a read for one of them on a podcast at work, like 2022, and I think back then I knew a couple of people. I had one, but that was just because I paid for a NHL subscription.
Sure.
Which was blackout. So basically, any NHL game, you pay for every NHL game on the app, but any that were broadcast in Britain, which were only a few, would suffer a blackout. Mm-hmm. So you would have to use a VPN to say I'm actually in Sweden, or I'm actually in Germany. It was so then it wasn't the gate you could watch the game. But that was the one function I used it for, the only reason I had it, and not that many people had them. But yeah, like that's 4 years ago now. They were it was like that was one of our few sponsored ads on that pod.
And now I just think that people, if you've got a VPN for your porn use, then you're like, well, now I'll use my VPN for Netflix as well. I'll use my VPN for HBO Max. I'll use my VPN for sports. Like, why would you not use it for all this other stuff. Like I just think that and look, I don't think that's necessarily like so wrong, but I do think that some of these companies perhaps do not realize how the landscape is going to change of, oh well, we have a monopoly on this thing because we have the rights in X or Y country.
Yeah, syndication is a real different beast now.
That works now when there are still old people who are not like literate in these sorts of things, yeah. Right? But before long, that will not be the case. Yeah. The majority of people will be like us. We are going to be middle-aged for like very, very soon. So anyway, it's more just that I think I should just be able to do what I want online without like being fucking overseen by the UK government, who can't even do their own fucking jobs, let alone regulate an individual person's like streaming or porn or social media or whatever. Fuck off with that. I just find it stupid and tedious and a complete waste of energy. And, you know, I've talked about this in the past, but the internet has just got so much fucking worse than it was. The internet used to be amazing. Like,
yeah.
Now, even if you've got, you know, an ad blocker, you just fucking have to, like, sometimes you have to turn your ad blocker off because you actually need to, like, close a thing because your ad blocker's making the page not work properly because of the way it interacts with a pop-up. Like, all that kind of stuff. Like, we just waste so much fucking time with all this absolute dog shit nonsense. And the internet used to just be like, you went to a page and the thing loaded and you could see it. And now it's like, oh, do you want to open Reddit on your phone? Well, you can't do that unless you've got a logged in Reddit account. It just like closes down basically. Do you want to go to a normal page? No, you've got to do like 3 pop-ups. Fuck off. Like, all this kind of stuff. Like, it's just dog shit.
You can't open this unless you download our app. There's no way of you getting this on your phone unless you
open the app. Oh my God. If you try... So, like, Google, obviously, on your phone, it's like, right,
yeah,
they're cunts. It's like, you can't do Google image search. You need to download the app. If you download that app, then sometimes it'll be like, we want to send you to Google Maps. Now you need to download that app. And I'm like, I don't want to download Google Maps. I've already got a fucking Maps app on my fucking phone. So it's trying to direct you from one thing from like your browser to an app to another app. And I was like, put it all in one app, you cheap cunts. Like, I hate this thing of being sent from one place to another. It's like, I'm not a fucking bitch. But just like, just put it all in one place.
When you open up Safari and you type, and you search in the, I think you can obviously, most people have it set to Google as their default search engine anyway. But you type in that in the search bar, just a question or whatever, it automatically Googles it. It goes to Google for that question.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you get the pop-up being like, do you want to continue in the Chrome app? Or do you want to continue in your, and like they make the continue in current browser.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the most confusing one to click. Mm. It's like the way they word it, the way they space it, the way the question they're asking, it's almost like a double negative.
I hate it when someone's trying to trick me.
You then have to look and be like, which one do I want to select? And how, like 30% of the time I click the wrong one.
Yeah.
And then it fucking opens up.
It says like accept and continue or pay and reject or whatever. And you're like, fuck off.
It opens up Chrome or it opens up worse, the app store that then says download. And you're like, fuck off.
It's like, you know, the thing people sometimes do in their stories on Instagram, you know, where they'll put the
on
they'll
the right hand video, side of the screen.
Put it over the right hand side. So you click it and it opens it. And I'm like, if I end up on your video, I'm not going to be happy to be there saying like, oh, this is actually a really good video. If I end up on your video, I'm going to say like, fuck you. I was trying to scroll. Like, don't ever fucking do this to me again. You belong in prison. Mm. Anyway, we're taking too long on the burn book. So let's like rip through the rest. What are you taking out?
So my one can be very quick. What I'm taking out of the burn book is Peelers. So Peelers, but not the institution, the docuseries. So Stephen Nolan, are you aware of Stephen Nolan?
No.
Stephen Nolan is basically Northern Irish Piers Morgan.
I was going to say, this is just going to be like some fucking Northern Irish guy. We're just like, oh, do you know who Stephen Nolan is? It's like some guy you know.
No, so he's like the third highest BBC paid BBC person each year or whatever. I don't know, he earns a ridiculous amount of money. But he's basically the Northern Irish Piers Morgan, kind of radio, TV presenter, controversial character, like loves to play devil's advocate, stokes the fire, is really Marmite.
Sounds like a cool guy.
He's really Marmite. But he has done this documentary series where he basically follows the PSNI around for like a year and a half, 2 years. Jesus. It's 6 episodes, 30-ish minutes an episode, right? And this is honestly one of the best things I've watched in so long. But it's not for the reasons you'd think. Because it is utterly ridiculous at points. And it almost comes off as like a mockumentary. So it deals with like loads of drug addiction, car theft, domestic violence.
Sure.
Gender violence, bit of rioting, some diffing. Do you know what diffing is? Are you familiar with the diff culture?
Diffing?
Diffing. Hit the diffing. hit the diff? No. Basically,
is
like,
this a Northern Irish thing or a crime thing?
It's both. It's
you know what I mean.
It's basically cultures, it's like country people doing donuts on back roads and like to basically Tokyo drifting, but around like country roads.
Diffing. Okay.
And it attracts like hundreds of people, but basically they like block off country roads and just do loads of donuts. And people come and watch it. People stand in the middle as the cars do donuts and stuff around them. So it's a wow. It's a weird like culty farmery kind of pastime. But it is obviously dangerous driving, so it's a crime. But there's loads of all that stuff in it. And
that shouldn't be a crime.
It's
you should be allowed to do donuts legally. There should be a place provided by the government for you to go and do donuts.
Go and do donuts, yeah.
Yeah, especially if you live in fucking Northern Ireland. What else you could do?
But
keeps you out of trouble. It's fine.
Keeps you out of trouble. Yeah.
I said trouble. I didn't say troubles.
Like, trouble keeps you out of the troubles.
Keeps you out of trouble with a capital D.
If you've seen any of the footage of the FLA that's happened recently, absolute scenes in Belfast. Like the Irish Music Festival, but it took over Belfast, and there was like hundreds of thousands of people who went.
Yeah, loads of people singing Van Morrison.
It was a real step forward for Northern Ireland's combined future for both sides.
Yeah,
it was. There's no way that that could have happened on that level. Not even 10 years ago.
Okay, great.
But
look, I've been to Northern Ireland. I had a great time.
Mockumentary.
I had some tato. Had some sweets.
Oh yeah, that was my wedding.
Yeah, I know. I was like, that's what I want out of this. Yeah. Like, I had Guinness, I had Tato, I had Haribo.
Yellow belly snakes, yeah.
Yeah, I was like, this fucking rocked. Like, what? This was like 3 days of magic, yeah.
But it obviously deals with some like harrowing stories and stuff, and you see really vulnerable people in vulnerable positions. Those parts are sad or whatever. But then Stephen Nolan, like, silence falls on set or like on scene. And then Stephen Nolan, in like pure Partridge Brent style, then like turns to the camera and starts doing like a super cringy piece to camera. Like pure like after school special vibes. I think one of them was like, he turned to the camera and was like, to think I've been having Chinese in that restaurant over there for 20 years. And just across the road, there's been people completely addicted to cocaine, ruining their lives just across the road from me in this Chinese restaurant. It really makes you think. And then he like slowly like walks away down the road, or like he walks off camera, and like the way he says it,
you got to say what it makes you think. You can't just say it really makes you think, and that's the whole thought.
There's so many little like CTAs with no substance, but just pure cringe, like with delivered like pure and with pure earnest as well. He means what he's saying, but he's just a complete caricature of a person, and like it feels like, you know, the CTAs are doing like location, 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 where they're trying to like set up a bit of jeopardy between like house A and house B, like which one will they go for? Sharon from Stoke is looking to relocate to Tuscany. She wants like 3 beds and a bath, but will this be the right tipple for her? And then like they walk off screen, and then it cuts to that. It's like that, but dealing with like fucking a guy who's just tried to stab his wife. And it's honestly, it's so absurd. It's so absurd. And it's really hard to explain if you don't watch it. So I do recommend everybody go on the BBC if you have access to BBC. If you don't, get a VPN, put it in the UK, go on BBC.
Yeah.
Look up Peelers. The most ridiculous part of it.
Peelers is such a fucking funny thing to call it.
The most ridiculous part of it is the intro. Like the intro title slate. The intro like title shot sequence. Honestly, it's one of the most ridiculous things I've ever seen. I don't even think I can explain it. I think you just go need to watch it, because it makes it look like kind of like Loose Woman-y almost. It's like really like purple and lights, and it's like really over dramatic slow-mos of people, of like the Peelers' faces, the police officers who are featured in it, like zooming in on their like really like intimate shots of just their face, but then with like this really weird like, it's just a really weird choice of track underneath it. It's so hard to explain.
Okay.
But it feels like it would be, if I was going to make a mockumentary about the police, that's the perfect intro. Like, it is the absolute perfect intro. So yeah, I just go watch it. It's also like super Northern Irish. Like some of the places in Northern Ireland may as well be Narnia. Like, it's absolute wild.
This does
like,
sound very Partridge-y,
like,
then.
It's absolute wild.
Yeah, okay, right. Oh, well, look, I'll check out the intro at least. Man, we need an intern for this show who can just pull together all the shit that we talk about.
But yeah, Peelers, okay. It's I think there's six episodes that are about 30 minutes each. If you want to watch something that asks absolutely nothing of you, bandwidth-wise, metal bandwidth-wise, this is great.
It shows so much about America, right? That when they had to come up with a nickname for their police, they came up with a kind of cool nickname. They were like cops.
Cops.
Sounds cool.
We have the and Bobbies here, and the Peelers.
All the names are embarrassing. Yeah, it's like, it's either about Robert Peel.
Yeah.
Bobby's Peelers.
Yeah.
Rozzers.
Pigs, bacon.
Or it's like, yeah, fuzz, pigs, bacon, scum, the cunts. You know, like it's something about like how we don't respect them.
Yeah.
I don't know, it says a lot about the cultures. Okay, right. What am I taking out of the burn book? Crudité supper. Boy dinner. Oh, okay. But more like garçon dinner. Where it's a little bit fancier. So Emma's been away this week, she and Coco in Finland. I've been left to fend for myself. And today, I forgot that we were shooting tonight, which I should have factored in, so I didn't actually get to do this. But I just went to like the Italian deli and I just walked around and picked up. I was like, I don't want to cook anything tonight. So I just walked around and picked up a bunch of like fun stuff, like some nice crackers, a couple of cheeses, a tin of fancy olives, you know? Just like Perilla. Some nice vine tomatoes. They're not Perilla because I wanted lemon stuffed ones.
Ooh.
Top.
Interesting.
Yeah, so a bunch of different things. And like I got a scamorza, I got a Sussex Charmer, and I got a little brie. And just like really good crackers, really fucking good crackers. And then that's your supper. Like at most you boil an egg to go with it. But basically you're having like chopped up like cucumber and carrot sticks, vine tomatoes, and just like little morsels. And it's such a fucking good supper. Like maybe a fancy crisp, you know, like a Torres or something.
Or Brett.
But it's honestly one of the best suppers you can have. It's also a great supper to have with your partner, right? Like Emma and I love to do this where we make the breadboard of treats and it just goes between us while we watch some fucking dog shit on the sofa.
Why do you watch Peelers on the sofa?
Yeah, while we watch Peelers. Or just like, I can't believe that while I was having a Chinese, people were out there doing drugs. Somebody was having a Colombian while I was having a Chinese. But yeah, you know, like, I just think that it's a really... Everybody acknowledges that it's very annoying and boring to think, what am I going to have for supper? And what I'm proposing is that if you have that issue, especially if you're in a relationship where you're like, fuck, what am I going to have for supper tonight? Solve the problem by having a little garçon dinner with your partner. Like get a platter of things. Okay, the cheese and crackers can be you know, quite a lot of calories and quite you know, if you're very health conscious, like replace some of the cheese with like some deli meats, some tinned fish, some smoked salmon, some smoked tofu, some you know, like one of the delis near us, it sells like they make their own pastrami, they make their own smoked chicken. Like you can do anything like that, or replace one of the cheeses with like cottage cheese, for example. That'll also give you a bit more protein. But like there are all ways that you can adapt this in a million ways, and it it's just very, very satisfying way to have a meal, I think, to just like sort of pick at it, graze, enjoy yourself.
I do feel this is good, but I do feel it lives and dies on accessibility, because we both have nice fancy little delis near us, but sure. Without that, I think you struggle to do a truly good one with like supermarket slot.
I think you can do a pretty good one with supermarket now. Like it's not going to be perfect, but you can go, if you've got a good supermarket, like if you've only got like shitty express supermarkets near you. Yeah. But then everything's rough, you know?
Yeah.
Then you're going to have to do a big online shop. Like that's how it's going to have to work. But the advantage of doing this is it normally does you more than one meal, right? Like if you have three cheeses, you're probably not going to get through all three cheeses in their entirety, right? So you can buy like four cheeses and add that to the next time, or bulk it out in another way, like add a salad to it or something. But yes, I agree, a deli does help, but I've also done it where I got nothing except from like the Waitrose near me. And that was, I mean, I realize Waitrose is more upmarket
biscuit
supermarket
deli anyway,
but it's still a fucking supermarket. Like, so that kind of thing. You can also go and get like a rotisserie chicken or something. Add that to it. Like, because rotisserie chickens are fucking cheaper than an uncooked chicken.
Yeah, it's why.
Rotisserie chickens are so reasonable, man. And then you can keep the bones in your freezer and make stock. So anyway, that is a supper I enjoy. I'm looking forward to having it tomorrow. I did eat a little bit of skamorza in front of Goldie. And she said, and me too. And I was like, no, not you too. You can have some fucking grapes. And she was like, grapes? Because she loves grapes.
Yeah, Bonnie just walked around saying cheese now. Cool. She's a big cheese.
Yeah, but she's a deli girl though. She spent half her life in that fucking deli near you.
She was in there at 10 days old.
She was in there at minus like 10 days old as well, yeah. Right? Like it's because she's tasted all the food from that place. Okay, right. We need to get on to the next episode. Yeah, yeah. Thank you so much for being here, everybody. We appreciate you sending questions in. We're going to be talking a bunch of those over on the paid side. We'll let you know when the next episode is going to be because we've got a bit of an awkward next couple of weeks. But please enjoy the start of the season. And yeah, you can always like tweet at me as well. If you have a question that we're not getting to on the podcast, just fucking tweet it at me and I'll probably answer it. All right, thanks. Bye.